Hi, I'm Catherine Galligan, and I believe that love is the most important thing, not only in the world, but in the whole universe. I created the Love to You All podcast as a platform to offer the wisdom and inspiration necessary for us to create a world where love is the guiding force. Together, we can release the protective barriers that keep us from giving, receiving, and fully embodying love. Join me and my guests as we explore the many ways to be the love for our world longing for change, peace, and hope. I believe it's my soul's mission to inspire the courage you need to be the most loving frequency you came here to be in this lifetime. I'm so glad you're here because we have got a world to change. Hello, and welcome back to Love to You All. I'm Catherine Galligan, the host of this podcast. And today, I've got an incredible guest to share with you. Her name is Jessica Buchanan, and she is someone who's, you know, she's been through the ringer. So she's not only survived, you know, just the unthinkable, and she has chosen to transform that survival into deep, meaningful contribution for the world. To me, this woman, she is changing the world, and I'm just so delighted to have her as a guest. But if you're not sure who that is, Jessica Buchanan, she is an author. She's written several books. She's a teacher. She's an editor, and she's the founder of SoulSpeak Press, which is a bespoke indie publishing house. She also just so happens to be a kidnapping survivor whose life totally changed when her convoy was ambushed in Somalia. She was there, you know, working in humanitarian education at the time. And this happened back in 2011. So, some time has passed. But, you know, what wound up happening, just this harrowing ordeal that this poor person went through, and probably most of us cannot imagine, Jessica's story actually started, in my opinion. So from my point of view, Jessica is so much more than a kidnapping survivor. She's so much more. To me, she's a spokesperson for women. And here's why I say that. So first, you know, that fateful and, you know, knowingly risky training trip that her employer required her to take into a pretty dangerous part of Somalia, Jessica disregarded her intuition, you know, and she talks about this. And now she's an advocate for listening to and trusting your intuition, which I dare say it's a woman's most valuable intrinsic resource. It's everybody's most valuable resource, but we disregard it. And, you know, intuition, it's not woo-woo, folks. It's a form of intelligence. And I really think it's time we start treating it that way. And I think Jessica is here to help me in that effort. But that's not the only reason why I consider her a spokesperson for women. The other reason, it's actually quite literal. She has gone on to create a non-traditional publishing house, and it's called SoulSpeak Press, which I don't think I could think of a better name. I love the fact. I mean, I love it so much. I'm very excited about it. But I love it that Jessica believes that if someone's taken the time to write a book, it deserves to be published. And so anybody who's ever written a book and tried to go to the traditional publishing route, they've probably run into some pretty major roadblocks. And then, you know, when you self-publish it, it's equally as daunting. And so she's created a really hybrid approach and a means for women to actually tell their stories. So SoulSpeak Press specializes in particularly amplifying the voices of women who have faced challenges and are ready to share their story and all the wisdom that they gained from that experience with the world. And this, I'm sure you can imagine, totally fills my heart, because it's not just that she's providing a way for a book to get published for these authors. She's providing an avenue for healing for them. It's quite cathartic to write a book about your story. But then that published piece of work then becomes, you know, a healing opportunity or a healing available to the millions of readers that buy it. And so I'm not sure I could think more highly of this person. I'm so grateful for what she's created. And, you know, we talk about it. I hate it, what she had to go through, but what it led to for her and what she's giving back to the world is just, it's phenomenal. So I'm pretty beside myself that our paths have crossed. And Jessica is a huge inspiration to me. And I think you'll hear why, because in our conversation, you know, we explore how trauma can become a catalyst for truth, for growth, and for purpose. And Jessica shares what it means to survive survival. And she talks about, you know, the role that faith and just the presence of her mom's spirit has played in her resilience, and now how she's helping other women share their own stories through their storytelling. So I cannot wait for you to hear this episode. Of course, always appreciate you listening. And without further ado, brace yourself for a huge dose of bravery, courage, resiliency, and inspiration. Jessica Buchanan, welcome to my show. Love to you all.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be here finally. It was a couple false starts, but here we are.
You know, all good things to those who wait, right? you're a busy woman. And so I hope I can express really and truly that I'm very grateful that you're here. And it's an honor. Yeah. So thank you.
Likewise.
Well, and I feel like a stalker. I'm just going to say that up front because, well, I mean, you know, when you write a book about yourself, then mm-hmm. it's like you kind of get into somebody's mind a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you've had a couple of podcasts, which I've had mm-hmm. a lot of fun just going down those rabbit holes. So I know who you are, but do you mind just like kind of telling my audience like what you've been through and what you, you know, sure. what you've got going on?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jess Buchanan to my friends, and I'm based in the DC area. I am a wife to mm-hmm. a native Swede, and I have two kiddos who are like just growing a foot every day. So every morning I get up and I'm like, oh my God, how'd you get so tall? We're substantially sized people, as I like to say.
I know this about, aren't you over 6 feet tall?
Almost. Yeah. And my son is steadily catching up to me. He's only 12, but we're at eye level now. So that God only knows how tall he's going to get. Let's see what else. I'm a teacher by profession. And so yes. I say once a teacher, always a teacher. And that's really where my journey started, was with my teaching career when I went to Africa, but I'll get to that in a minute. Let's see what else. I am an avid hiker. And I think the thing that people probably find most interesting about me is that I'm a kidnapping survivor. So moving into that story, I, you know, grew up in the Midwest. I always say I'm just, and there is no just a teacher. Like, I never mean to disparage teachers. It's the hardest profession. It's the hardest thing I've ever done.
Yeah, it really is.
Oh my God. They are doing God's work. I'm telling, there's a reason why I don't teach in the formal classroom anymore, because it is so freaking hard. And I just, all respect. At the time of this recording, it's the end of May. My kids have 2 weeks left of school, and those poor teachers, I'm just praying for them that they can make it with their sanity intact.
Amen. I hear that.
But I grew up in the church, Midwest, you know, just very conservative, but also, you know, my family had its ups and downs, of course. My mom struggled with her mental health, but, you know, I knew I was loved, and close relationship with my parents and my siblings, and then felt compelled to go out and see the world and to make a difference. You know, that was really how I was raised. I think with this, I think it was at home, and also because I spent so much time in church, I went to Christian school. Mm-hmm. There was really this concept or belief, I guess you would call it, at least that I internalized, like, to whom much is given, much is required. So, you know, I don't think I ever have done anything out of guilt. It's just been more about like responsibility. And I still very much function in that way. Like, I have been given this life. I have a set of tools. I have talents. I have resources that have been given to me, and I should be using those, right, to try to make the world a better place, you know, forgive the horrible cliche. But so I went to college like 5 times. It took me a long time to figure that all out. I took the scenic route and finally got a teaching degree. And in the middle of all of that, realized, I really want to be out in the world, and I want to go explore, and I want to serve in that capacity. And so Ended up going to East Africa a couple of times and started teaching at an international school. I did my student teaching at an international school in Nairobi, Kenya, and they offered me a job and I very happily took it. But of course, about a month and a half into my contract, I meet this cute Swedish guy at a really trashy nightclub when I'm out with some of my teacher friends on a Saturday night. And we've been together for about 18 years now. And so he at the time was the equivalent of like a human rights lawyer. So he's working for a Swedish NGO and his organization moved him up to Somalia because that was really like his area of expertise, working with the Somali people and the government and the parliament and all of that. And so we got married about a year and a half after we met. And we didn't want to have a long distance marriage. So I quit my job at the school and moved up to Hargeisa, Somaliland, which is the northern part of Somalia with him. There were a lot of expats up there. That's where most of the nonprofits or the NGOs were based. It was a non-family duty station though. So, you know, that meant that the level of security probably wasn't awesome.
Okay.
In layman's terms, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't a place where you were going to bring your kids, whereas Nairobi was a family duty station because
yeah.
it was pretty westernized and had healthcare and, you know, that kind of stuff. Hargeisa did not.
Did you have trepidation about going to Somalia then? I mean, what did your family think about it?
What did my family think about it? I think that they like trusted Eric and felt certain that he knew what he was doing because he'd been working there for a long time. And I think they also knew that like I was just going to do what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Like they were used to me just like, you know, I'd been caught in like LRA attacks in South Sudan. I'd been, you know, flown in 2-person prop planes in northern Uganda. I was like living my dream.
You're and like living
no
on
one
the
was
edge.
Yes, kind of. I'm not like an adrenaline junkie or anything, but I just had this avid interest, this curiosity, a kind of borderline obsession with what was going on in that part of the world. And it just felt like the work that I wanted to do felt meaningful. And I ended up getting a job with an NGO that was based in Hargeisa, the Danish demining group.
Let me clarify one part of your story, if I remember this correctly. But you went to Africa, and there, it's like a day or two after you arrived, the camp was under attack. And so you almost immediately turned around and went back home.
Yeah.
And so
we left.
You returning, that takes a huge amount of bravery and courage and some sort of unspoken drive or curiosity that would compel anybody to go back.
Well, that's very generous of you. I think a lot of people would say I was just being stupid, but
I think your higher self was guiding you. Yeah. Cause when I think about your health, and we can get into it later, but I think that you very much were supposed to be there. All of that was supposed to happen. Do I want you to have suffered? No. Do I wish that upon anyone? You know, of course not. But like your life was unfolding as it should. And so now you found yourself back. You've married this beautiful man. Mm-hmm. You guys have moved to Somalia.
Yeah. I mean, it's a job, right? You know, like anything else, it's an industry. But it also has, for me, I think, and for Eric, deeper meaning. Like, you know, I mean, we could have easily just stayed back in our respective countries and, you know, done the job thing. And,
I had a job as an accountant after college.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a job. That's not deep meaning, you know?
Yeah.
No,
I was after the full-blown, like, live life out loud experience. Like, if it didn't, I don't know. I've just always been a person who is like in massive pursuit of purpose. And if I don't feel like there's meaning in what I'm doing and it doesn't matter to me or it doesn't matter to somebody else, then like, what's the point? Like, that's just how I am. I've always been that way.
You know what? I'm right there with you. And I don't want to talk about the weather to people. I feel like when that does start happening, we're just sitting around lying to each other. Mm-hmm. And it's like, why are we even here? Like, what is this?
It's like, It's like sitting at all the sidelines of the soccer games right now. Sometimes I really struggle, but anyway, I digress. So yeah, like, you know, I'm a teacher, right? So teachers always land on their feet. I wasn't worried about getting a job or whatever. I figured somebody around Hargeisa probably wants to learn something. So,
yeah,
you know, before I knew it, I had a dining room full of Ethiopian refugees who wanted to learn English. So I was playing memory games, you know, with these full grown men who got really excited when they were able to match the vocabulary word to the picture. And, you know, it was just, it was fun, but word got out that there was an actual like real teacher in town. And so I started doing work, like just consultancy work for the UN and the Ministry of Education, writing curriculum for them. And then that's what led me to a full-time position as the regional education advisor for the Danish demining group, which was the is the mine action unit of the Danish Refugee Council. So really, really large NGO with a great presence, you know, all over the world, but certainly in East Africa. And it was great. I was traveling all over East Africa, back to South Sudan, Northern Uganda. And we're talking like outlying areas where, you know, you're on these little planes and they land on a dirt patch and you're like taken by a convoy of land cruisers into these villages in the mountain. I mean, it was just like, we worked in armed violence reduction, community safety, mine risk education. That was in particular what I did, was create curriculum and materials for non-literate people groups and, yes, and kids. So, you know, and then of course I worked all over Somalia, and all of these, you know, all of these environments are incredibly diverse and very different from each other. You know, people act like Africa is like all the same, but in fact, it's like 54 different countries. I don't know if I have that number right, but something like that. And they're all very different. And right. So, you know, it was just, yeah, it was incredible. It was hard. Sometimes yeah, it was scary. You know, mm-hmm. I find myself like being the only person staying on a compound and being a single female at night, like on a compound in yeah. the middle of South Sudan felt like scary sometimes.
So, no kidding.
You know, but yeah, so I fast forward to October of 2011. My job required me to travel down south to southern Somalia, Galkayo. We had a project base there. And so if Hargeisa is like maybe like a level 2 in from 1 to 5 scale of security, yes, where I was living, where I was based, Galkayo probably would have been like a 4.
Oh my gosh.
And so we were able to go in and do work, but there were lots of security protocols that we had to follow. They were constantly following like reports from the UN, and we had to travel with armed guards in Hargeisa all the time. So I was used to that. But the security level was kicked up several notches. And I felt really nervous about going down there. I just didn't want to do it.
Right. Yeah. Like, okay, stop right there. This is one of my favorite parts of your story. And this is why I think it's like what you're doing now, like, is so relevant and full of purpose. But, you know, one thing about a woman, the gender, like our gender, our intuition's it's unbelievable. And and I'm sure you've noticed, like, especially as a mother, like it kicks up 10 notches.
Yeah.
And so it's such a valuable skill that's discredited, or it's, you know, it's not considered legit. And so therefore it's almost like we weren't given the right to trust it, you know, and like, and for it to have a voice at the table or a place at the table. And so had those circumstances been different, we might not even be having this conversation today.
Yeah.
Right. You might not have even gone, like, you would have stayed safe and whatnot.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
That wasn't the case. So,
right. No, you know, and it's interesting too, because I've thought a lot about this and done so much reflection and so much work around this idea of this concept or this truth of intuition. Yep. And I think for me too, growing up as like in such a religious environment also impacted that ability to trust my own intuition and my own voice, because it was very much like cloaked in this, well, what is God trying to tell you? And so I also think that like lends itself very much to the patriarchy and you know, God always speaks to us through men, you know, right? Mm-hmm. And at least in in the way I grew up, the head of the household. Yeah. You know, all of that. And so I think there is just this natural inclination of, because I've been conditioned by my culture to defer decision-making in general, but especially when it comes to things like security, you know, cause, and also like I'm in a very male dominated like environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were women for sure. And I actually, the organization at the time, my boss was a woman, my immediate supervisor, and then my counterpart was a woman. So we, you know, we were one of the only offices that was being run by women. But outside of that, it was just all men, like, especially like retired military. And so, you know, they're tough dudes. And I'm this like, I don't know, this like outgoing, outspoken American who's just like very creative and not very cerebral and driven by my emotions. And they just didn't really know what to do with me. And I think a lot of them didn't understand why I had the job that I had, but I was actually very good at what I did. I just did it very differently than they did, you know?
Right.
I'm not going to do a monitoring and evaluation report, but I'm going to create materials for your, you know, constituents or your beneficiaries where they actually learn something because I know how to approach it pedagogically. So it was, you know, I just kind of felt like I was constantly fighting to prove myself, which plays into this decision to ignore my intuition.
Well, you're like fighting City Hall in a way.
Institutions, right? You know, and so I tried to, I did cancel the training. I was supposed to go down to Galkayo. I canceled it twice. And then I called my counterpart down in Galkayo, an older Danish gentleman, Paul, who was a friend of mine actually, and said, I just don't feel good about this. I really just don't want to come down here. And he was basically like, well, you know, if you're not going to do your job, you don't want to do your job, then we'll find somebody who can. And I'm like, ugh, okay. You know, I get off the phone. I talk to my husband, you know, well, did you follow the protocols? Have you been in, yes. I've done all the things, but I still just don't feel good about it. And it's kind of like, I came to the conclusion, like, what's the worst that can happen?
Okay.
It's like the most ridiculous conclusion to come to when you are in a place like Somalia. But I get on a UN plane, like, I go down to Galkayo. Yeah, like a lot. But, you know, again, too, like, it's hard for me to like conceptualize now because this was over 10 years ago, but like you're desensitized to a certain extent too, because you're just used to living in an environment where there are weapons everywhere and there are bombs going off and there are people get killed every day because they get caught in the crossfire. Like this is just
the norm. A norm
for other people in the world. Like we're so lucky.
They're so pampered.
Yes, absolutely. So I think it wasn't too far out of the realm of, I mean, and I think you have to do that a lot when you work in those environments, being like, okay, you're just being paranoid. Get out there, do your job, like that kind of thing. So, you know, I pulled my big girl pants up and did what I needed to do. And I got down there and the training was 3 days long. The first 2 days, I wasn't worried about that because they were in the north office where we were staying. So I didn't have to leave the compound. It was the third day that I was really worried about because we had to get across this boundary and move into another part of the city that was governed by another clan. And it was really complicated and there was a lot of clan conflict. So we needed to get across to the south to train that part, that the southern staff. And so we did. We got across, did the training, and I'm like home free. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I'm thinking, okay, I was just being paranoid. Ugh, I'm ready to get home. Yeah. Like I'm leaving the next morning. I'm thinking about what I'm going to do for my workout and if I have time before dinner to get it in and, you know, all of this stuff. And then as we're driving through the city, another vehicle comes up on our right side and cuts us off and splashes mud up all over our windows and our windshield. And I remember very distinctly looking up and like looking around the Land Cruiser and saying like, what a jerk who drives like that to the car.
Right. Yeah.
And then it sounds like we're being surrounded by very angry men and they're slamming weapons into the car. And then a door's pulled, this security advisor is sitting on the right side of me and his door's pulled open and there's a very angry man dressed in police uniform with an AK-47 standing there. And he pulls him out and slams him to the ground and gets into the car and puts the gun to my head and starts screaming at the driver to drive. And I'm I mean, it's like slow motion, right? My brain kind of starts to turn to sludge. Like I can't really process what's happening and what's going on. And I have two just very rudimentary, basic thoughts as we're just tearing off through town. And this driver is just like, the wheels are coming up off the ground and we're slamming back down. And all I can think is like, this is so bad. This is so bad. This is so bad. Like whatever this is, I'm not convinced, or like, I'm not sure what it is. Like, I don't know if we're being carjacked. I don't know what's happening, but it's so bad that I have nothing to reference. Like I don't think I've ever seen a movie, or I've never been trained for this. I don't know what to do because I have no frame of reference for it. And then the second thing I keep thinking is like, no matter what happens, like even if they stopped right now and just shoved us out and let us walk back to town, everything in my life has changed from this point on. Like I know in that moment, fundamentally in my DNA, everything has changed.
Okay.
From this moment forward.
Yeah, it has. It did.
Mm-hmm. It did.
Yeah.
It did. And what I've come to understand is that these are those things, like we all have that moment. Like it may not be a kidnapping or a carjacking, we all have a moment where life blows up in our face, and we can allow it to change everything, or we can allow it to change us.
So, that's just so powerful. Thank you for saying that. Mm-hmm. I want to share a little. We have a fun fact. We have a trivia fun fact of our lives on October. So that happened on October 25th of 2011. So the day that you were getting kidnapped and your whole life changed, I decided to stop drinking alcohol after being kind of in the throes of addiction. And so that date is important to me. Like truly my life actually did change, and it put me on a path. So for me personally, it put me on a path towards authenticity. Mm-hmm. And I dare say that's what happened with you too. Like that's part of it. It's part of how things changed for you. Yeah. It's like, I'm only going to honor my truth going forward once I get out of these circumstances.
Yeah.
And so, so October 25th, everything changes. Mm-hmm. And within a few minutes, are you starting to realize, okay, we're hijacked. And this is not going to end here. And so
it took me a while to figure. And I don't know if it's just because my brain knew I couldn't handle it. I think our bodies are like really wise, right? And our minds protect us. And I'm just like in every single minute trying to figure out what I do. Like I had this beautiful ring that I had just had designed and made that had my mother's diamond in it. I had lost her the year before. And so I thinking about like, how am I going to, where can I put this without him seeing me so that it doesn't get stolen? You know, I'm doing stuff like that. I'm trying to follow every order because I'm afraid he's going to shoot me. I have an AK barrel to my head as we're like, driving 90 miles an hour through the desert, which is like not an easy feat. Paul's in the front seat, in the passenger seat. And at some point he turns around to look at me and I just mouth, what is happening?
Yeah.
And I will never forget the look on his face. It was pity. It was like, oh, she hasn't figured it out yet. And he said, we're being kidnapped.
Wow.
And I'm just like, okay, yeah. I think I'm gonna have a panic attack. I think I'm gonna have a panic attack. Like that's what I'm like. How do I manage a panic attack? Because I had anxiety is my thing. Like I deal with anxiety, and I was really like struggling with anxiety and panic attacks at that point in my life. And I'm thinking like I don't have any medication. Like I have never felt so much panic as I felt in that moment. And it just went on and on for hours and hours. We drove, we stopped, we changed vehicles, we drove more, we stopped. New people would get in the car. At one point, there was a man hanging out the window next to me with a machine gun because it didn't fit in the vehicle. It was so long. And, you know, and then we changed vehicles again. And I hear a high-pitched voice behind me, and it turns out there's this little kid. He looks like he's 9 or 10, and he's wearing belts of ammunition. He's holding an AK that's as big as he is, You know, I mean, it's just bizarre. And then after hours, probably 7-8 hours of driving, I don't know where we're at. It's dark. We're in the middle of Somalia in the desert.
This episode is brought to you by my online membership for women, Emerge. Think of Emerge as a launchpad for becoming the most unapologetically authentic version of yourself. Inspired by the Year of the Snake, which is all about transformation, this space is for women who are done playing small and are ready to live with radical honesty and deep self-honor. It's not always easy to shed old skin, which is why you don't have to do it alone. Each month, we meet as a support system for one another and for an enlightening masterclass where I blend the magic of Ayurveda, feng shui, and astrology to help you align your energy, your environment, and your whole vibe with what the universe is up to in real time. So if you're craving alignment, empowerment, and real connection across all aspects of your life, Emerge is for you. This is the year of sacred shedding, and it's all preparing you for new levels of abundance, clarity, and freedom. You can join Emerge anytime. Link to register in the show notes.
There are so many men. I'm the only woman, and they force us out of the vehicle and order us to walk out into the desert. And I think it's just, it's your primal, I don't know, just your instincts take over, right? And my instinct for some reason in that moment was to say no. I figured I was going to be sent out there and they were going to, you know, gang rape me and then shoot me.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, I don't think I thought anything. I'm just like instinctively putting up a fight. Like, I'm not going to go down easily.
Yeah.
And so we get into an altercation and Paul comes over to me and he says, we got to walk. Like, you know, we have to walk, like we have to follow orders. And so we do. And you know, I don't know how long we walked, and my memory may not be super accurate at this point, but it felt very, very long. You know, half an hour, 45 minutes deep, deep into the desert. All I can think about is like, I'm never going to see my husband again.
Yeah.
I'm never going to see my dad again. I'm calling out to my mom, kind of like in a prayer sort of way, like asking her to help me. It was very important to me that I didn't beg. I just wanted to be dignified and strong, even though I was going to die out there in the middle of this desert. For sort of whatever reason, I had no idea why, you know, and I can also remember thinking like I was 31 when this happened. So like, I never had kids.
Yeah.
Like, I never got the chance to be a mom. And so regret, right? You know,
like
when they talk about your life flashing before your eyes, I think it really does. And all of the things that I didn't get to say and the things that I didn't get to do. And it was terrifying and it was so sad. And I'm just weeping silently.
Yeah.
Because I had every part of me believed I was going to die in those moments.
Well, what else can you believe in those moments? Mm-hmm. I mean, that it kind of seemed like all the arrows were pointing that way.
Yeah. For sure.
You know, I was wondering about your mom, and you had mentioned that she had mental health problems. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the spirit of like reframing, you know, we have the gift of this, right? When we look in the rearview mirror, and it's like the anguish that she would have had for you, you know, had she still been alive and like to witness that, it could have been so overwhelming for her. Like in a weird way, it's like, oh, thank goodness she was spared of that, you know, in the human life. Mm-hmm. And like, and I do think that like our loved ones, like I think when we do pass on to the other realm, we're almost more powerful from that place than we can be in our human form. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if like on some level she understood and the timing was so much so that she could be that source of comfort and power for you. Like, is that a possibility in your mind?
I mean, anything is possible. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is it
was very present with me. So insanely present. Like, I can't even.
You wrote about it.
There were moments, where this, like, there was, I mean, I try to trust my memory, but, you know, it's fragmented by trauma and
right,
PTSD and everything else. But there was this one night you know, they would move us over and over again. So we would, be sleeping, like, and whatever that means, you know, you're laying on the ground on a mat and out in the middle of a field. So, and then they'd come over and start yelling at us to, like, get up, you know, essentially, like, we need to get in the car. We were moving. We were always on the move. And there was this, it was pretty early on before I could kind of like figure out exactly what was happening. And I just remember being driven further into the desert, same kind of situation, shoved out of the car and ordered to walk. And so we were like hiking through the desert in the dark. And there was this mountain off in the distance. And I could see the mountain because there was this star and it was hanging really low and it just kept getting brighter and brighter and brighter. Yeah. And in my memory, it was almost blinding. And I know it happened because Paul was walking in front of me and he turned around and he was not like a man of faith or anything. He looked at me and he said, you see that, right? And I said, yeah. And he's like, I think it's your mom.
Oh.
And I was like, yeah. I think it is too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, she was just so present and so such a source of strength for me and comfort. And you're right. I, you know, she was there for me during the kidnapping in a way that she couldn't have been if she were here in her body. But then at the same time, she wasn't there for my, like, family in a way that perhaps they needed to. So,
yeah.
So I don't know. That's bittersweet, but I like where you're going with that. So I'll agree to that.
Okay. I'll take that one. Was Paul a source of comfort to you while you were there?
Comfort? No. How would I classify him? Maybe security.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no comfort. No.
Okay.
He was like a foot shorter than me and it was his fault this happened. You know, I found out on day 27 that he told me there was this kidnapping, a direct kidnapping threat on the organization that he had not disclosed to me because he didn't want me to
change your
cancel
mind.
The trip. So, okay. I mean, what do you do with that? You know, when you're like, you might be the last person I ever talked to in my life. Like, I'm going to have to put that on a shelf and deal with that if we get out of here because I need you in order to not go insane.
Yeah.
So maybe like I could classify as him as entertainment or something along those
lines. A distraction or
distraction. Yeah. But not comfort.
Okay. Okay. I didn't realize that. Wow. Mm-hmm. That's hard. Are you in contact with him now?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. No. Okay.
Okay. That's been my forgiveness journey. People always think that like, oh, it must've been so hard. Like, how did you forgive your captors? And I'm like, that was no problem. That's not a big deal. It was Paul and my organization and just their absolute negligence and lack of duty of care. And then the way they treated me afterwards.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's a shame, but I think it's very, I think that that's how the, you know, these agencies work. You know, it's kind of like, well, you know what you're getting yourself into. You're the one who signs off on your personal security. And I'm like, yeah, if I have all the information, you know,
right, I like mean, to make an informed like, I can't, decision.
Yeah, like you took away my right and ability to make an informed decision about my own personal security by not disclosing information. And it wasn't just Paul who knew, it was the security advisor who gave me permission to go in. And then my supervisor. And when I went and debriefed with them afterwards in Copenhagen and said, you know, I was just like hysterically crying at this table with them, like trying to get across to them how much my life had absolutely changed and all of the things that I was dealing with in the aftermath. And they just said, we didn't consider it a viable threat. Hmm. And I'm like, it's Somalia.
Right.
There are known terrorists and pirate like activity in the area. It's always going to be a viable threat.
Right.
So
yeah, it's hard. I mean, that is hard.
Yeah.
I can only surmise that it's because you had like, it's almost like the universe was colluding in a way or conspiring so that this had to happen to you. Mm. And I do think I think that you could accomplish everything that you've accomplished with Soul Speak Press. I mean, I really do like you are a capable, really strong, resilient person. Mm-hmm. And that's abundantly clear. So, you know, I don't want to suggest that you wouldn't have been capable of great things without this mm-hmm. event happening, but it did steer you in this direction.
Sure. Yeah.
And so it's strange how mm-hmm. like that. Yeah, it's like it's almost like these soul contracts that everybody had, like, okay, we have to play our part, mm-hmm. you know, as, you know, and it's going to ruin my relationship with Jessica, and it's going to put mm-hmm. her in great danger, and it's going to really scare her, and it's going to, mm-hmm. you know, but I guess I have to do this so that she continues on this trajectory. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's a very esoteric way of looking mm-hmm. at it. And, you know, and it is a reframe. It's like, okay. And I don't want to suggest that it's easy either to like consider right. like, okay, oh yeah, well that was supposed to happen. No problem. Sure. I'll sit in the desert for 90 something days, right. you know, in extreme terror
right.
and, you know, and not knowing how things are going to turn out. But
yeah. It's to look at it. That's a hindsight, the right. gift of hindsight, right?
It is.
In reflection.
Absolutely. And it's, and I admit that it's a stretch, but I think, you know, it could be a stretch. Mm-hmm. And so I think from my perspective, how I see it is I'm so grateful you survived mm-hmm. because of what, not only just, you know, you get to go on and experience life and have a family and be a mother mm-hmm. and all the beauty that entails, mm-hmm. but you've become really important. I think that you're super important for change, like world change. Mm. And it's unbelievable. Mm. Like it makes me kind of like emotional to think about it. Mm. And so, yeah, it was really hard what you did mm-hmm. and like had to go through. And you've rebounded beautifully. And I know, mm-hmm. I know there's been issues with, you know, grief and PTSD mm-hmm. and all of that. And I hope you can share with us a little bit about mm-hmm. that. But what you have gone on to create is so incredibly powerful. Like, I just can't even say.
Oh, thank you. I received yeah. that. I needed to hear that because sometimes we get stuck in the day-to-day, the muck of,
yeah.
you know, life, and you forget. And you don't know, right, until somebody tells you, I guess, that you just have to trust, like, I mean, my life has just been one big faith walk, you know, it continues to be. And I yeah. just don't know, right? I'm just putting one foot in front of the other and trusting, trying, complaining a lot, trying to work on that. But
I think it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big believer in things not happening to us, but for us.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's an act of choice. And I know that that doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah.
So, but you know, it's how I make it work for me. And that's how I get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
And everybody's got to figure out how to do that for themselves.
I know.
But it has taken a lot of work. And the thing I keep thinking lately, this has been my mantra over the last couple of days, is just because it's hard doesn't mean it's impossible. So I don't know why that keeps going through my head other than I don't know. Like, I don't know if something hard is on its way and I'm getting prepared or what, but maybe somebody needs to hear that today, that just because it's hard doesn't mean it's impossible. So
yeah,
life is
not easy.
No,
it's not.
No,
no. I mean, and I think you just illustrated my belief about you perfectly that, mm-hmm. I mean, that level of resiliency, it's one you have to cultivate it,
yeah,
you know, and I don't know that we're necessarily just graced with that, you know.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's intrinsic, you know, and I mean, that's the thing too that I think about a lot is like, some of us have, you know, we're fortunate to have been given tools and
yeah,
perhaps like support growing up. And I think, you know, the hard things, like I think about the hard things that happened to me in my childhood, you know, when my mom was really at her worst, and like that is what develops resilience, right? Also,
yeah.
The flip side of resilience is trauma. And so just knowing that I needed and committing to mental health resources and healing and taking time for me has been what has built my resilience. It just takes a lot of time.
You know, it really does. And it takes what it takes. And I, mm-hmm. I think we have such an interesting relationship with time. Like, oh, she should have been over that by now.
Yeah.
Or, you know, yeah. are like, you know, be grateful for what you have and move on. And, mm-hmm. and well, no, it's not that easy. And mm-hmm. I think it feels like, or it sounds like that you have had a lot of stones to unturn, like overturn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Since being rescued. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, do you remember that news program that was like the rest of the story? Like, I think people think of you, and what you said this at the beginning of our interview, like what you're the most known for is mm-hmm. your kidnapping. And I actually want to change that because I think what you're most known for is like you're a voice for women mm-hmm. and you are, I mean, you've created a medium for people to express, for women to tell their stories and for these to be heard. And they're important stories. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it's not just like a fun beach read, yeah. you know?
No.
It's not.
There's very little fun in the stories that we promote. I mean, some people are like, I can't handle this. I'm like, that's fine. That's fair enough. We're not for everyone, but
yeah. But,
you know,
but I think it's important. And yeah, and it's not for us to think that you were just going to bounce back and mm-hmm. like, and I want you to keep going with your story. Cause I mean, it's just so fascinating. It's like that, you know, and the minute you got home, it's like, now you find out you're going to be a mother. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, so there's a rescue involved. I mean, and mm-hmm. I mean, please share as many details as you want, but sure. It's like, you have been on the move. Like, you know, it's interesting, like you're kidnapped and you're in Somalia and they're constantly moving you. And I feel like it's like you got to a safe place, but you're still just like on this move. Mm-hmm, like your move hasn't ended.
No.
It's just like life just like keeps throwing you things.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I was thinking about that the other day. I was like, wow, all within the span of 3 years, I lost my mother. Then I got kidnapped. Then I had my first child.
Yeah.
And so like and I moved to continents. And so, yeah. So, you know,
one of those days alone.
Yeah, exactly. It was just, I'm like, no wonder I'm so tired, but, we're kept outside. The ransom demand started at $45 million, which is just bonkers and unfathomable. I believe they had gotten it down to 4 million by the time day like 90 had rolled around. Unfortunately, I had gotten a urinary tract infection from being mm-hmm. outside because we lived outside the whole time.
Yeah.
And so, just you know, like, I'm like,
not very sanitary.
No, there's no house. There's no shelter. There's no tent. There's no toilet. There's nothing. I'm just out in the bush in a shower.
Eating tuna fish with a tampon
applicator, which was clean and new when I started eating off of it.
Yes.
People have a real hard time with that whole concept. It had moved into a kidney infection. And so my last proof of life call was January 16th, 2012. And I basically said to the family communicator on the other end, you guys got to do something, get me out of here or I'm going to die out here. And, you know, this can be on you. You all need to get me out of here.
Yeah.
And unbeknownst to me, of course, I had no idea that like when this is a violent crime committed against an American abroad, the FBI gets involved. So Matt Espenshade, who is the lead FBI attaché in Nairobi, was just a godsend. He was working closely with my family and really just took them in, and his family supported my family so much. And Eric took that information to Matt, and he said it was like a movie. Matt and I guess two other agents were in there. They just looked at each other and walked out of the room. And he knew in that moment something was going to happen. He didn't know what was going to happen, but he knew something was going to happen. So, you know, every day of captivity, President Obama, who is the sitting president at the time, was being briefed on my whereabouts and my, you know, physical state. And there are a couple of things that have to happen in order for a rescue attempt to take place, to be ordered. And one of those is if there's imminent death, like pending for the hostage, whether that be like they're going to be assassinated or health. My health had deteriorated to the point where they felt pretty sure I only had a couple weeks left. And so that started the wheels in motion for an actual rescue operation.
Yeah,
so
it's like it met the criterion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so January 24th into the 25th, 2012, you know, I wake up, I'd fallen asleep on my mat and I woke up because I needed to be sick. And there were 9 pirates on the ground that night, but they were all passed out, completely stone cold asleep. And I got up and like crawled to a bush to do what I needed to do and then came back to my mat. And then about 30 seconds later, the night just erupted into automatic gunfire. And I thought we were being kidnapped by another group because that was always a threat.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you can imagine, it was pretty gruesome and pretty horrific and it didn't last long. And then all of a sudden somebody grabs my legs and my shoulders and pulls a blanket off of my face. And I'm trying to protect myself because I think, you know, I don't know what's going to happen to me. I'm so terrified. Once again, I'm very weak. I'm very sick. And then I hear this young American man's voice say my name. And he says, "Jessica, you're safe now. We're in American military. We're going to take you home." Like shock just completely overtakes me. And all I can do is start shaking. And I just keep saying, "You're American? Wait a second. I don't understand. You're American?" Like I just never crossed my mind. Ever.
Right.
Like that somebody even knew where we were.
Yeah. You know,
I felt very confident that the only way we were going to get out of there was through paying the ransom that my organization was going to have to do that. And so that was literally the shock of my life, you know, and then I get carried to safety on the edge of the camp. And my first question is, "Where's Paul? Did he make it out alive?" And he's sitting there and he's like, "Do you know who these guys are?" And I'm like, "I have no idea who these guys are. I have no idea what's happening." And he's like, "This is SEAL Team 6. These are the guys that got Osama bin Laden." And I'm just like, I'm sorry, what? You know, it's been 12 years.
Yeah.
No, 13 years.
13.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't count. But, you know, I mean, I think about it every day. I talk about it every day. It has become a part of my identity for better or worse. I mean, there is a lot more to me.
Oh, but, yeah. Like, but, do you mind talking about it? Like, does it take you... do you want to break free of talking about it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, okay. I think about that whole idea of not letting something define you, but I mean, this has defined me. Like there is no way. And I kind of counter, sometimes I'm like, I should apply to do a TED talk on this because I think that like letting things define us doesn't mean that we let them steal our futures. I think we let it direct our futures.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of ways. And, you know, we wrote Impossible Odds basically. So we had, you know, yes, I got pregnant 3 days after the rescue. I have no idea. I mean, I know how it happened, but I mean, just the sheer shock of finding out that my body was able to actually conceive is incredible. And, you know, then I've got this baby and I'm like, got postpartum depression and anxiety and PTSD. Yeah. And I don't know who I am anymore. I think motherhood is like,
it's an identity crisis.
Yes. Anyway. And then like, who am I? I've lost my job now. We have to leave Africa. Like it was just, oh man, it was so hard. And that's what I call like that space and time is called surviving survival, which is what my next book, it comes out in October. That's what that's about and that's a really long survival journey as far as I'm concerned and not something we talk about nearly enough, but that was hard.
I really agree. I mean, I can only sympathize because I haven't walked that journey, but that is so much. Mm-hmm. I can't believe what you've gone on to do. Mm. I really can't. Like that's enough to like set a lot of people back.
Yeah.
And they would be fine with being set back by that.
Right.
You know?
And I think it's okay too. Right.
That's their path. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And my dad said to me, like, my dad and I are very close, and he said, you know, no one's going to blame you if you just sat and stared at the wall for the rest of your life, you know? Like, you have been through a lot.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, But I feel like I kind of sat and stared. I did that version out in the desert. Like, I think I'm good. I think it's time. Like, and I also felt like I had this obligation, right? To like live a life. Like, I didn't need to go cure cancer or start a foundation or anything. But, you know, like I was very aware that these men like jumped out of a plane and left wives and babies at home to risk their lives.
Yeah.
They very well could have died. Like I needed right. to, I wanted to make my life have an impact and use this story in a way that helped, you know, promote what the SEAL community does and how important they are to, you know, our country. And also just to like figure out how I could use my story to encourage other people to listen to their voice and to listen to their intuition and tell their own stories. You know, I love that saying that I heal out loud so that those who are, you know, what I heal out loud so that those who are recovering in silence know it's possible or something like that.
Well, and yeah,
I think it's important.
It is because you're unshackling so many people by being vulnerable in that way and sharing your story. Because you could just be a private citizen.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what Paul did. I mean, he just went off and he went back to work. And I think he did one interview. And I, as far as I know, again, I don't have a relationship with him or in, online or otherwise, but he doesn't talk about it. But I've gone on to talk about it. And I'm sure all people have all kinds of, especially all those, I can say this because I'm married to a Scandinavian, but they're kind of private. So they don't understand how Americans, like we talk about. And I'm just like, yeah, well, you know what? I really don't care. Like this is, I feel this is what I'm called to do. And this is my purpose now. So.
Yeah. I think so too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was wondering about that, like kind of, yeah, these people rescued you, you know, like they put mm-hmm. their lives in danger. And so mm-hmm. did that pose, did you start to question like your worthiness?
Oh,
did
yeah.
you start? Yeah.
Okay. Oh yeah. That was a journey for sure. And that's something that I've written about a lot. And I've interviewed a lot of other people, other survivors of trauma about that. Like we are, you know, it takes a while to get to that point, but you're allowed to want more. Like, mm-hmm. I think I thought for a while, like, oh, okay, I like capped out the capacity of good in my life. Like I can't ever ask for
like
more.
Like a cat's nine lives.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. Like, no, there's Jess Buchanan should not ask for one more thing in her life, you know? And I walked around like that, you know?
Yeah.
But that's no way to live.
No.
And actually there's just a, there's, it's not, it's never ending how much good can come into our lives. And, yeah. you know, that's part of, been part of my healing journey.
Good. Yeah. Like, thank you more, please. Like, it's okay.
I'm an incredibly grateful person.
That's awesome.
I have done so much work around that. My husband, you know, sometimes I'll be like, you've seen what I've come from. Like, you know how hard I've worked to get here. And he's like, yeah, I know. I see it. So,
yeah. Well, I was wondering too, like, can you admit or can you receive like how special you are? Like, yeah, mm-hmm. like you are worth it. And like, mm-hmm. yeah, that it was probably their honor to save you. Mm-hmm. I wonder if their higher selves, you know, like mm-hmm. on some level know like this person, we got to save this person. She's going to go on to do a lot of good in the world. Mm-hmm. And not because, again, not because you have to or because you feel guilty or have survivor's guilt or whatever. It's because like, yeah, there's this mission that, you know, that drove you back to Africa despite a pretty clear warning sign like, mm-hmm. hey, this might be unsafe.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, okay, I'll take this assignment, even though, yeah, this might be unsafe. And it's like mm-hmm. you kept going and you kept accepting the assignment, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so now here you are and, you know, alive and well, mm-hmm. and you've gone on to create something beautiful. And so do you mind sharing what that is?
No, absolutely. Yes. So, you know, I've been speaking and writing for 13 plus years now.
Yes.
And so I took a little time off and went back to teaching and then COVID hit and that just was like, oh, yeah, no. And what I found was that women kept coming to me and asking me like, how do you, like, I have a story to tell, but I don't know where to start. And I was like, oh, well, I can teach you. And then I thought, oh, wow. Okay. And then of course, Providence, like, you know, created this meeting with my mentor and one of my dearest, most gorgeous soul friends, Krista Clive Smith, who's the founder of Merrick Publishing.
Yes.
Who we created an imprint with, Soul Speak Press, and it has been 3 years. And I don't even know how many books at this point we've published, how many women's stories, several hundred at this point. And it's just been so incredible to walk with these women through their storytelling journey, teach them about memoir writing, teach them, you know, the logistics of like what it means to go through and the editing process and peer review and publishing and launching a book, but also to hold space for them and to hear like them say, I didn't know that I could reach another level of healing, but writing about this thing that happened to me and what I've learned and what I know now about myself and in life has been transformational. And that feels as meaningful to me as going out into the desert in Africa, teaching kids about the risks of mines.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's a completely different purpose, but it's just been such a pleasure and such a joy. And I'm so grateful that we get to do this.
And as you should be, because I'm sort of in this like spiritual community where people, I mean, they really are trying to find their purpose, you know, and they want to not just find their purpose because they know it's something big and beautiful, but they also want to like monetize it in some way or, you know, or like align their career with it because that's what feels meaningful. And it's like, and you found it. Mm-hmm. And I did want to ask you, how much of your role with Soul Speak Press would you say it is like logistical, like getting the actual thing published and whatnot, right? Like helping writers through that process.
Yeah.
But a huge part of it is you're holding space for their healing.
Yes.
Is that more your dharma, would you say? Like, is that your purpose? Is just like, because I remember somebody hearing that you're an Enneagram number 4 and like you guys just, y'all can hold space for that.
We do in a pretty impressive way. Yeah.
And
I think I'm able to, I have this strange knack for hearing what people aren't saying.
Yeah.
You know, and reading in quite literally between the lines.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my job as an editor is to get our writers, help them feel safe enough to get to the truest part of the truth.
Their story.
Their story.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's gentle, but I spend a lot of my time saying, go deeper, go deeper. I think you can go deeper here.
Yeah.
And it's painful.
Oh, it's painful. Yeah,
I bet. Most of them will do it. Some of them won't, and that's okay. They're just not ready. But for the ones who are ready, and you know, it can be brutal. But oh my gosh, the other side is just—it's like incredible.
So much freedom.
Mm-hmm. It really is. It really is. So.
And then you have this like tangible material product that is like a legacy.
Yeah.
For everybody who needs that healing, and so it's like it's not just like one-on-one work that you're doing. I mean, you're truly reaching millions.
Yeah.
And that, it's amazing.
These are books, they sell. People love them. And, you know, and it's a community. We've built a community, you know, with the anthologies that we do and
working with this cohort.
Yeah. So it's been really cool. So
before we started recording, you mentioned a 3-year cycle. So do you kind of work in waves of three,
of
3 years. And so you're kind of seeing this one come to an end.
Yeah.
A 3-year cycle. Can you anticipate like what's next for you?
Well, this summer I'm definitely taking a lot of time off. So
we
have a couple of anthologies that we're working through, but I'm not taking on any more. We're taking authors on, but I'm not working directly with them for the foreseeable future.
Okay.
And I have my second Well, this will be my fifth book, Survival, How to Turn yes. Life's Hardest Moments into Meaningful Contribution for the World. That manuscript is out with beta readers right now. And mm-hmm. so we're working on that. So that I think that's what's next. Then I'm planning on starting a podcast as well. And I really want to focus on stories, the storytelling aspect of the surviving survival. I really am nice. So fascinated by how people do decide to move into that space of like, letting the trauma change them for the better. And so those are the stories I really want to work on putting out into the world. So,
yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see okay. how it all unfolds. Again, well, it's a faith walk.
I look forward to that. That won't be your first podcast. You're
no,
seasoned.
No. Yeah.
Seasoned with this at this point.
But this will be different. We're going to do it in person and yeah. Oh, it's going to be
a production.
Lift. Yeah. It's a okay. production. So we're putting a lot of energy and money toward it. And so we'll see how it turns out.
It's going to be awesome.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I receive that with an open heart.
Good. I'm glad. Well, and if I may call you Jess,
absolutely.
And thank you so much for being here. This was, you know, everything I had hoped, and you are beautiful. I mean, on the inside and out, that what you're doing is unbelievable to me, and you have my never-ending support. And so I'm just so grateful to have gotten to meet you, and I thank you for your time.
Oh my goodness. Likewise. I'm so grateful. Thank you for the opportunity to share my story. It really means a lot.
Absolutely.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Love to You All. If you're enjoying this show, please share it with someone who you know would benefit. That would mean the world to me. And another fantastic way to support the show is by leaving a positive review and a rating. It just takes a minute. It would make a huge difference. I hope this message reaches as many people as possible. I really appreciate your support. And so until next time, so much love to you all. I want to extend a heartfelt invitation to join me this September in the south of France for something truly special. I'm attending the Sacred France Retreat, a transformative journey into the heart of the Cathar region, a land steeped in the mysteries of Mary Magdalene and the Divine Feminine. This is not just any retreat. It's a chance to remember love as your true path, to open your heart, and to reconnect with the deeper truth of who you are. Held by the sacred land and soulful community and powerful intention of this retreat, I am going because I know this space will support the kind of deep alignment I'm always talking about. And if something in you is stirring as you hear this, I hope that you'll come too. Details are in the show notes. I'd be so honored to share this journey with you.